From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Franklin Kameny was an American astronomer working for the U.S. Army in the 1950s and fired for being gay. A full decade before the Stonewall riots in New York ostensibly gave birth to the modern gay rights movement, Mr. Kameny led the charge for dignity and rights for LGBTQ Americans. Now, a young historian has written a biography of Kameny called The Deviance War, that casts a much-needed light on a figure who ought to be a household name. Eric Cervini is an award-winning historian of LGBTQ plus culture and politics. He graduated summa cum laude from Harvard College and received his PhD in history from the University of Cambridge, where he was a Gates Scholar. And his first book is entitled The Deviance War, The Homosexual Versus the United States of America. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I have to confess, I had never heard of Franklin Kameny. Is he well known in the LGBTQ community, or is this something that just historians of the community have known about?
It's definitely the latter choice. His name is well known within the study of queer history and within the academy, but as a young student and undergraduate, you know, the only gay activist whom I knew was Harvey Milk. And so he hasn't quite reached the level of so many other heroes within our movement, and he should be up there alongside them, because historians have long recognized that he was the grandfather of the gay rights movement, yet so few of us know his name.
And is that because he really started speaking out in the 1950s at a time when, you know, you just don't, looking back on, say, pop culture of the 1950s, you don't see that visibility of an, you know, overt demand for gay rights.
Mm-hmm. And he was really the first to fight back in the 1950s, the same time that Senator McCarthy was targeting communists and alleged security risks. The federal government was also targeting at an even higher rate alleged sexual deviants, as they were called. So if you were gay or gender nonconforming or queer, you had no place in the federal government. There were multiple laws that said, or regulations rather, that said that you had no place in the federal workforce. And so you were purged. And this was happening at the rate of thousands each and every year in the 50s and 60s. And Frank Kameny was the first to fight back, taking his case against the Secretary of the Army all the way up until the Supreme Court, the first openly gay man to do so. And this is 60 years before last month's decision for employment equality.
Right. So let's talk about how Franklin Kameny started out as an astronomer. And if we lived in a just world in the 1950s, he might have remained a practicing astronomer. Tell me a little bit about his origins, if you will, and then, you know, how he ended up working for the U.S. Army and was fired.
Well, I always like to introduce him as first and foremost, he wanted to be an astronomer. He did not want to be the grandfather of the gay rights movement or a gay activist at all. Growing up in New York City in the 1930s, as a small child, as a six-year-old, he recognized that he wanted to study outer space, study the stars, went to Harvard and graduated in 1956 with a PhD in astronomy. And that exact same year, he was arrested for homosexual activity in a public restroom at an astrophysics conference in San Francisco. And within months of him getting a job in the Defense Department, the government, of course, found out about his arrest and immediately purged him. And he was barred from working not only for the federal government, but from working in the aerospace industry because it necessarily required a security clearance. So he was barred from following his dreams for the rest of his life.
So rather than sort of accept his fate, he decided to fight back. How did he, I imagine that at that time there might not have been very much legal precedent to bring his case, right? And we were still arguing about who the Civil Rights Act of 1965, which was passed 10 years later, mm-hmm. even encompasses or includes. So how did he view his case as one of discrimination?
Well, it's a great question, because as you said, there was no precedent. There had been a couple of Supreme Court cases involving freedom of speech, but when it came to equal protection and when it came to due process of federal employees, the only thing that he could really rely on and that his volunteer attorney that he found who worked with the ACLU but was not officially working under the auspices of the ACLU, they only had due process cases as precedent. So they could only look at alleged communists or security risks and make sure that he was getting his due process that was afforded to him constitutionally. And it was up to Frank Kameny, after that failed, after those arguments failed, to prove to the ACLU and to other civil libertarians that gay rights was a valid civil liberties issue, because all the way through the 50s and well into the 60s, the American Civil Liberties Union and other activist organizations refused to acknowledge and in fact condoned the gay purges and the Lavender Scare, as it was called, during the 50s and 60s. And so he was really responsible for persuading these other activists, these other straight attorneys, that gay rights was a valid issue.
So what sort of community did he have in the 1950s? Because as the name of your book suggests, the deviance war, this idea Americans who identified as gay, lesbian, queer, gender nonconforming were simply relegated as deviant, as abnormal, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so many people assume that there was no openness and there was no gay culture or queer culture before Stonewall. And one thing that other historians have done is prove that actually that's not true. You're tracing all the way back to the beginnings of the 20th century and even back before that. There were vibrant subcultures in many major cities across the country, and Frank Kameny took part in them. And even in Washington, D.C., there was a vibrant gay world. It was a segregated one. His was very white. There also existed a Black gay world in Washington, D.C., but he drew upon his social connections and the queer spaces, including several gay bars that existed, many more than exist now currently in Washington, D.C.,
really?
To create essentially a movement. Yeah, absolutely. And some of these bars, you read about them and you say, oh my gosh, I wish these existed now. But of course, because of the internet, queer spaces, at least physical spaces, are really diminishing.
So tell me about, and you write about this in your book, tell me about the Mattachine Society and the role that it played in fostering that community. It was a national sort of, is organization the right word for it, or community, I guess?
Sure. Yeah, organization. It actually began all the way back in 1950. I'm currently in Los Angeles on the east side near Silver Lake, where it was founded by a group of communists who said, we can apply the exact same logic that we apply to workers as a minority that does not know that it is oppressed, that does not know that it exists as a minority, and apply that exact same framework and understanding to the homosexual minority. Because at the time, no one really believed that there existed a coherent homosexual or queer minority group or community. It was simply a behavior, at least to the general public. And so Harry Hay and other activists within this organization, the Mattachine Society, which was a very obscure reference to a medieval jesters who criticized the throne from behind their masks, they said, you know what, we deserve our own culture and our own minority group, and we need to be fighting for our rights as a minority group. And that was something that actually went away. It kind of diminished after in the second half of the 1950s, but Frank Kameny was the one in the 1960s who brought it back and brought some of that radicalism and militancy to the East Coast, and fighting this notion that all we need to do is fit in and act straight. And he said, no, we need to be fighting back.
So meanwhile, what happened to his case? How long did it take to work its way through the court system?
Well, it took several years. His attorney eventually abandoned him once he wanted to continue appealing up until the Supreme Court. So he wrote a 60-page manifesto, his own Supreme Court petition for cert. and he wrote it entirely on his own. He was not an attorney, certainly, but it is so remarkable because it is essentially a manifesto of the pre-Stonewall homophile movement or gay rights movement that is remarkable in that he claims as a legal strategy that to be gay, to engage in homosexual activity, as he called it, wasn't just not a bad thing, but it was actually morally good. It contributed positively to society. And he made that claim openly. He did it as an openly gay man. He submitted his lawsuit as a Kameny versus the Secretary of the Army, Rucker. And those are the two components of pride, asserting your own morality and doing so openly as part of a marginalized group. And so that's why I argue he really established the foundations almost a decade before Stonewall of what we now celebrate each and every June as Pride.
How did he just survive? If he was basically had his career curtailed, fired from being gay, essentially not allowed to work in other areas as an astronomer, how did he survive, especially considering that he was out in the 50s and 60s?
Mm-hmm. He barely survived, but he did. And a big part of that is because of his privilege, which is something I think we have to talk about and I have to analyze in the book, which is, you know, he was a cis gay white guy just like me. And because of that, because he was able to pass in many other settings, he was able to survive. He had a network of other white gay activists and friends within Washington and across the country who gave him loans, who supported him. And he also had a family in New York City. They were not necessarily living in poverty. He was able to get loans from his mother. And so it really shows that it was someone who had the job in the first place, who had the privilege and the education and had the actual paycheck to begin with, who is the one who took up the fight. And I think that's something that I'm very critical of, this early movement, that so many of these early activists, the only reason they were able to fight back is because they were benefiting from other parts of their identity. Whereas you look at the Black freedom struggle, they were simply trying to get the right to vote, the right to even apply to jobs, and being even to access some of the gay spaces that I talked about a lot of. If you were gay and Black in Washington, D.C., you weren't even allowed into those bars. And that was de facto segregation. So I think it's important that we also name some of these other factors that allowed him to construct a movement and allow us to ask, what does that mean if the movement was so white and so male dominated before Stonewall? And I think it shows us just how important Stonewall really is.
And so would you say that Frank Kameny laid the groundwork for the Stonewall riots? I mean, was his work one that those who were involved in Stonewall and those who built upon Stonewall, did they also build upon Kameny's work?
Yes to both. I think the riots were the result of so many different factors. Violent resistance was so incredibly common throughout the late 1960s. And also, you know, one of the reasons why it was so important was, as I mentioned, because Frank Kameny's movement was exclusionary, because, you know, if you wanted to participate in one of his marches in 1964 and 1965 and beyond, if you were a man, you had to wear a suit. If you were a woman, you had to wear a dress and heels. So if you didn't conform to gender norms, or, you know, you weren't a member of that organization, or you had too much to lose because of other parts of your identity, then you had no place in that movement.
And was this because of this idea that, you know, some have called the politics of respectability?
Exactly. Exactly. Because even though he claims that he was fighting the strategy of respectability and claiming that to be gay was inherently good, which was a very radical statement at the beginning of the 1960s, by the end of the 1960s, he was staying a little bit too attached to that strategy of respectability, is exactly what you just called it. And as a result, especially after Stonewall, he was eclipsed by a new generation of activists who completely distance themselves from the strategy of respectability. And quite frankly, that's part of the reason why we don't know his name, was because he allowed history to progress without him. And I think it shows us a lesson of how, especially in a year like this one, and in a decade that has been and will be full of so many more changes, we as activists need to stay ahead of the curve. We need to be cognizant of how norms and communication and language are changing, and also ask ourselves, who are we forgetting in this moment?
Right. I want to pick up on what you were saying, this idea of gay is good. This was a slogan that he sort of came up with that put a moral framework on the gay community at a time when it was inherently seen, or gayness was seen as inherently, quote, deviant or not normal or not good or not... not something that was deserving or of equality. How was that received? Did that, as a slogan, start to take hold and start to change the culture and start to change minds?
It did. And he developed that phrase in 1968. And you have to also look at, where did that phrase come from? Mm-hmm. Well, he heard on television, I found the letter where he describes the moment when he heard on television the phrase, "Black is beautiful." Which was very commonly used by people like Stokely Carmichael and the Black Power movement. And he recognized that to simply be fighting in the courts, to be lobbying congressmen, or to be even picketing outside of the White House was not enough. He needed to address the same thing and the same sense of inferiority and of immorality that the Black Power movement was addressing in preventing Black citizens from joining the cause. He recognized that same phenomenon occurring within the queer community. And he said, well, we need that exact same strategy, that same tactic of persuading sexual deviants or homosexuals or queer Americans that we actually are just as morally good as anyone else. And then if you truly believe that, it becomes much easier to demonstrate. And even though he allowed the politics of respectability to hold him back, it wasn't until Stonewall that you see a huge explosion in scale. And I think you really start to see him start walking the talk, because until that moment, until Stonewall, even though he was proclaiming gay is good, how can you also be forcing people to dress a certain way and to project a certain form or a certain image of what a good gayness means? And so it's a complicated story, but I think there's a lot to learn from it.
Let's talk about intersectionality. Where did the non-white male gay community fit in Frank Kameny's world?
Well, as I mentioned, his world was very white. And I think it's something that we have to be critical of, because he, and I talk about it in the book, they did try to make efforts and outreach to especially gay Black people in Washington, D.C.
And what about
women? Really follow through. And women, you know, it depended on the part of the decade. The Mattachine Society was actually overwhelmingly co-educational. It was about 50-50. And after Stonewall, especially the Gay Liberation Front, for example, in Washington, D.C., was overwhelmingly male. And part of the reason was you see also a rise in lesbian separatism. After 69, and you start to see women saying, wait a second, this homophile movement or gay liberation, that doesn't include us. That, you know, even once you're allowed to have sex in public restrooms, how is that going to help me as a woman, as maybe a mother, with my own set of difficulties? And so you see the splitting that I think is really unfortunate and that we need to learn from and be asking ourselves, how are we excluding others in our movement? And I think it's something that Frank Kameny eventually came around to, recognizing that if you're exclusionary, if you fall into this trap of respectability, it's ultimately going to hold you back.
Frank Kameny died only, what, a few years ago, right? So he was around to see not only what the post-Stonewall era brought, but also I imagine he was around to see at least the beginning of the cultural shift in the United States around LGBTQ rights, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, he passed away in 2011. And thankfully, it was during the Obama administration, which recognized his importance and also the error of past administrations. And so he actually received a formal apology from the successor bureau to the Civil Service Commission, which had been responsible for his own downfall. The federal government issued a formal apology, and he simply stood up and said, apology accepted.
Wow. So that came full circle from the way in which he started his legal fight.
Exactly.
So here we are in the last few minutes of this conversation. I just want to ask you, you referenced the recent Supreme Court decision. We have made a lot of progress, and the fight that Franklin Kameny helped to start has come such a long way, but it still seems like there is such a long way to go. And we are now in perhaps the most reactionary periods in American government history. What are you fearful of happening between now and December, assuming that the Trump administration's last few months are now through December? What are you afraid that he'll sneak in under the door before he leaves? Because he has essentially promised his base that he is going to be as homophobic as possible, as anti-transgender in particular as possible, because that's how he appeases them.
Exactly. And the Lavender Scare, the gay purges, began as a political tool. It was a way to delegitimize the Truman administration, just like Joseph McCarthy. That was his, it was a political game. And now in an election year, you're going to see the exact same phenomenon occurring. And you already named it. The Trump administration, despite the Supreme Court ruling, is already targeting trans Americans. They're already removing protections, including health protections. In the middle of a pandemic, the Republican Party is waging a war on transgender children, and Black trans women in particular are being murdered. Last year, it was at the rate of once every 2 weeks. This year, it's at the rate of once a week. And it is another pandemic that we're facing. And I think as we ask ourselves where we failed in the past of queer activism, we need to ask ourselves now, as I said, who are we forgetting and who can we be fighting for now? And I think that particularly is the trans community, especially Black trans women. And so many organizations are doing the hard work and have been, including the Sylvia Rivera Law Project and the Marsha P. Johnson Institute. So I'd encourage anyone to go look at their mission and consider contributing.
And in fact, is the transgender women of color or trans non-white transgender community in the U.S., you think that's sort of last front of, or the most vulnerable subsection of the LGBTQ community that is still fighting just for dignity, just to be seen as whole and human and not deviant? And I should have asked you this about during the question around intersectionality, but where did transgender people fit in Kameny's world?
I think that's one of the areas where I'm most critical of him and most critical of that early movement, because if you subscribe to the politics of respectability, which is, you know, we have to project normalcy and morality in order to win, and we have to sacrifice those who don't conform to that image in order to gain the approval of, you know, whether it's the Democratic or the Republican Party, I hope the book shows that fails always. And you see this horrific trend throughout history, whether it was the 70s, excluding Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson from the movement, whether it was before that with Frank Kameny, excluding anyone who deviated from gender norms from participating in his demonstrations, all the way up until the 2000s with the Human Rights Campaign removing trans protections from its proposed anti-discrimination legislation, it still failed. And so I think you see now, I hope people recognize that, yeah, we have to tell these stories. We should still tell them with respect and understanding of the context, but we also need to call out the failings and be cognizant of them as we continue the movement today.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Eric Cervini, award-winning historian of LGBTQ plus culture and politics. We've been talking about his first book. It's called The Deviance War, The Homosexual Versus the United States of America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.